Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business, and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome, welcome. Well, today we'll hear from returning guest, New York Times bestselling thriller writer Catherine Neville. But first, we're joined by Canadian Ken Murray. He's a writer and teacher of creative writing. His work has appeared in numerous publications. And while earning his MFA, he also trained as a teaching artist with a community word project and taught with Poets House. He's the recipient of numerous awards, including the inaugural Marina Nemeth Award and the Random House Award, and he currently teaches at the University of Toronto's School of Continuing Studies and Halliburton School of the Arts. He has a new book out. It's called Eulogy. It's a novel, and we're going to hear more about that in a moment. Ken Murray, welcome.
Hello. Thank you. It's good to chat with you today.
Well, and it's good to chat with you, too. And are you still in Toronto? Because somewhere when I was reading that out, I thought I read that you'd moved somewhere else.
I don't live in the city. I go into town once a week to teach and come on home. I live out in Prince Edward County, which is kind of on lake, is a little peninsula sticking out into Lake Ontario, sort of on the road towards Montreal when you're leaving Toronto. And it's a beautiful sunny day out on the beach right now.
Okay, well, lucky you, because it's very great. We've got typical Seattle weather here, but that's okay, because we've had a fabulous summer.
Oh, good.
So this is an interesting book, because it's based on some of your own experiences, and yet it's not autobiographical. It's pure fiction. Is that correct? Let's get that out of the way
Let's get that out of the way. This book is pure fiction in the sense that this character is not me. The characters, his parents are not mine, and the events that happened certainly they have not happened. But one of the things that plays out in here is you have an adult man dealing with the religion of the home he grew up in. And, you know, that's an experience I have had, because I did grow up in a household where there was a religion that I have since gone on to, you know, leave.
Right.
And, it's funny. I actually just published an essay in The Humanist. It's on their website, thehumanist.com. It's called Raised on Televangelism. So you can get some background on that. I think that title tells you a lot of the background there. You know, as a kid, we spent a lot of time waiting for, the end of the world and all that stuff to happen. So.
Right, right. And so you, as an adult, you set out and started questioning that at some point, I'm guessing, by yourself. And that's some of what's going on in the book a little, too.
Yes, yeah. I mean, really, what you have here, I mean, just for our listeners, the background of the story is what you have is an adult-only child who, through a traumatic event, which is the death of his parents, is forced to kind of look back, is drawn back into the world he kind of ran away from, which was, you know, the small town life, a parent's marriage that was in shambles, and from a religion that he at one time had big hopes for helping him out, that had since failed him, that he'd walked away from. So he's forced back into that world by their death. And, you know, it's a trauma works itself out in different ways, right?
Right, right. And there is a lot of stuff that he has to work out, because he has to face, he's built this life, as you said, for himself, but it's a very, very protected kind of existence.
And he's hermetically sealed.
Yes. And so suddenly, at the death of his parents, he has to face the obsessions, the denials that have helped develop him as a man. Delusional family history, religious fundamentalism. As you said, his parents were thoroughly miserable as a married couple. Forced starvation, secrets, get-rich-quick schemes. I mean, there's all kinds of things going on in there.
Yeah, it's not something you file under H for happy, yet we do have some laughs in there along the way, which might be my great accomplishment here. So basically what's happened is, you know, the cautiousness and I guess the insulation he's put around himself in adult life is almost like the mirror image of how unprotected he is as a kid. So and having never dealt with that, he just grows up. I mean, he takes a job where he can work alone in a controlled environment. He flees from any pain that could be caused by relationships with others, but causes pain to himself. You know, in many ways, he's kind of playing out. You know, if you look between the lines in the story, as he tells the story of his parents, it's kind of like there's a violence that happens between them, a verbal and emotional violence that happens between the parents with him in the middle. And it's almost like that plays out on him and the way he lives his adult life. And like part of this story is what drives it is, can he get through this?
Right.
Can he get past this? That's really what drives it along.
So let's look at how the story idea came to you for this book. I read it was a total of 11 years in the making, and you basically had the idea from two different stories that you'd written, and you realized, short stories, and you realized that that character in both of those stories was actually the same boy.
Yeah, that was a moment along the way. The very first moment, I think, was a little bit before that realization, and that was when I kind of first discovered this character. You know, I was like, something that happens to me, I don't know if it happens to everybody, but it happens to me, is sometimes, you know, just a mental image will get under my skin and it won't go away.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, the image was a father and son who go to an amusement park, but it is not fun or amusing. It seems like they're going through the motions, but there's something wrong, there's something missing. And what happens to me, you know, I'm a writer, and when something like an image like that gets under my skin, what I do is I just try to write it out. And so I did write a short story about that scene, but it left a lot open. I had to, it's like, who is this kid? Who was his dad? And importantly, down the road, what happens to them? And so there was that key moment, though, that you're referring to, yes, where in writing another story, which I thought was independent, it's like, no, this is the same character showing up here.
Mm-hmm.
And so when that starts happening, it's like, aha, okay, yeah, something's going on here. So keep writing and let the scenes come out and find out who these characters are and let the story make the links. And it was a lot of time put into it. And, you know, you work on it, put it away, think it's perfect. You know, you put it away, think it's perfect, come back to it 2 months later to read your masterpiece, go, oh, no.
I know that feeling.
And then you're like, okay, well, you know, I'll grieve for a day, and then I'll get back at it. No, I know how to fix this. And then, you know, you work for months and months and months, and you put it away thinking, I've done my masterpiece. And you come back, you know, a month later, it's like, here we go again. So that is the endless cycle. And eventually you get to a point going, no, this does feel like the book. This book feels whole, and the story feels like it's holding itself together.
Yeah. And so ultimately you ended up writing about the man and not the boy.
Yes. And the reason, you know, what happened when we're somewhere along the way there is when I finally had a full manuscript, which was much longer than this one, it was only a story about the boy between about age 11 and 12, just following him in that time from the moment he tries to fix his parents by going into this fundamentalist religion to the moment where he realizes this just does not work for him. Right?
Right.
And the problem with that story is that it just left wide open the big question, well, what on earth happened to him? You know, leaving him off at 13 years old with this realization that, you know, he's in this bad spot, that story called out for it. So that's when I began to, you know, that was, you know, some 5 years into this, 5-6 years into this, these 11 years, I said, okay, why don't we find out, sit down and think through what his life as an adult could be like.
Yeah. Well, that's maybe that just the journey you had to take to get where you ended up.
Yeah.
So, all right. So we need to take a quick break here, and we will be right back. We're talking with author Ken Murray. His new book is called Eulogy. And when we come back, we'll find out more about it and more about how this... Well, I know that Ken had a lot of questions when he was writing this book about his own life, so we'll find out more about that when we come back.
Had to get out of my mind. Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
You listen when your body says, "I'm tired," or "I'm hungry." What if your body said something else might be wrong? Gynecologic cancers, cervical, ovarian, and uterine cancers have symptoms, so pay attention. If your body says something may be wrong, please listen. Learn the symptoms. Get the inside knowledge about gynecologic cancers. A message from HHS and CDC's Inside Knowledge Campaign.
Hi, this is Vicki St. Clair with Conversations Live. If you'd like to gain more exposure for your business, service, or event, or if you'd like to raise awareness for an issue or topic you're passionate about, call me. Let's talk about ways we might partner to shine the spotlight on you and bring you the recognition you deserve. Call me at 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617. Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Listen to podcasts of past shows at conversationslive.net.
Get a grip on life with Alternative Talk 1150.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, and my guest in this segment is Ken Murray. His new book is called Eulogy. And Catherine Graham, author of her Red Hair Rises with the Wings of Insects, says, "Eulogy is a powerful and riveting exploration of the family, the tensions between father and son, mother and son, and mother and father through the sharp-eyed, sensitive voice of William Oakes. Masterfully mesmerizing." That must make you feel good, Ken.
Catherine was very kind to write that.
So let's.
Yeah, it does. It is. It does feel good to hear that. Yes.
Well, let's talk a little bit about in writing this book. I read that you said you'd answered a lot of your own questions. What was the most important question that you answered for yourself?
The most important thing that came out of this book for me really happened after the fact, and I didn't even realize I was doing it. I was mentioning that article I put up on The Humanist recently, and it kind of gets around this. One of my first or second talks I did about this book was a public talk up in Haliburton, Ontario, while I was teaching up there this summer. And I got asked a question at the end of this talk, says, how did writing this book change me? And it's an amazing question, right? Because I never gave that a thing. Here I am 11 years with this story, and I hadn't given it a single thought. I had no idea. I mean, I won't say I had no idea. I had every idea the moment I heard the question.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, I could answer right away without even thinking about it, was that this book gave me a much clearer understanding of my relationship with the religion in which I was raised. I wasn't seeking that,
right.
But it happened, and I'll just accept that as a gift, right?
Right. In what way did it give you a clearer picture?
It allowed me to see that the fundamentalism in which I was raised was not of my choosing, and that I'm not beholden to it. This happens to be what was in our house, and it didn't work for me. And it's also allowed me to be a bit more compassionate towards what I think some people call the wacky religions, right?
Mm-hmm.
In the sense that, these things are populated by humans, and some people get something out of them, and you can't begrudge them that. You can begrudge somebody committing crimes in the name of religion, or telling people what to do with their bodies in the name of religion, but I can't begrudge people finding comfort in them. And uh, so in a sense, like, it just kind of, I just felt a bit more open.
Yeah.
In the sense that, you know, I'm not, the existence of these religions that I reject does not enrage me. It's like, here it is. They're here. They're part of life. And, you know, people go to these because they work for those people.
Well, right at the beginning of the book, you have a chapter there where his parents, the character's protagonist's parents, call him a sexual deviant and spread it around the church for just being a normal, you know, young man.
Yes. It's pretty harsh. we do push the limits in fiction, don't we? But at the same time, you know, I thought I was pushing the limits doing that. And yet, you know, here closer to the East Coast, you know, in upstate New York, just 2 weeks ago, two parents were charged in the beating death of a kid at a church service.
Yeah.
And I read that, and I was like, what? You know, how does this happen? And then all of a sudden, I started thinking back. Well, we know how this happens, you know. People find comfort in like-minded thinking. Become convinced they know the answers, segregate themselves so that they're not hearing any other voices. And then in that segregation, in that echo chamber of ideas, anything different becomes suspect or perhaps seen as evil. And it's certainly a risk. We all live in our own little sealed chambers of information, right? Socially or whatever.
Like We do.
We do.
Our own historical reference, yeah.
Yeah. I think that, you know, if there's one thing, it's also taught me that, well, we've got to be open and able to listen to people we don't agree with.
Right.
Is that, you know, it's probably, as I think more about this stuff, something that comes home more and more clearly every day. And I don't mean it in any kind of new agey or kind of hippie way, but like part of being alive is being around all kinds of people, not just the ones who say and think like we do, like I think.
Yeah.
And it sounds real simple, but it gets a little complicated out there in the world.
It does. And, you know, there are, I'm thinking when I was reading some of the reviews from your book, I like to, you know, read what the layman's written versus the professional reviewer, etc. And everybody pretty much enjoyed the book.
Yep.
A couple of people said it's difficult to read because it's kind of depressing, but they're talking about the subjects you're talking about. But they all agreed that they got through to the end because the story pulls them through. And you do use humor in there too, which lightens it. And I'm thinking of a couple of other stories which made mega hits. One was The House of Sand and Fog by Andre Dubuc, and I could not get through that book at all because I found it too depressing. And the other was Vinegar Hill. I don't think I even made it through 50 pages of that one because I thought it was kind of bitter, but I didn't find that bitterness in your book. So talk to us a little bit about, you know, how you deal with such difficult subjects, because people, I think, do, to some extent, learn from reading fiction.
I think the difficult subjects attract me. I don't know why. To me, stories where people aren't somehow in conflict don't work for me. I mean, they can work on the page for others to write them, but they don't inspire me to write. You know, a pattern I've seen in my fiction, which happens here, is people who want to be loving and who are limited in their capacity to be loving. And as soon as you create a situation like that on the page with characters who are real, and, you know, that's my job, is to make them as real as possible and that the reader can connect with, there's inevitably going to be moments of frustration or heartbreak or anger at what happens to them. And I think the greatest challenge is to try and realistically portray these situations without giving up hope. There needs to be, you know, but again, at the same time, when I bring hope resolution to anything, it has to feel like, it has to fit the story. It has to be right for the story, or else then I'm just cheating the reader, right?
Yeah, it has to be authentic, because readers can smell inauthenticity a long way off. Inauthentic writing, yeah.
We can't just do the, and then I woke up, it was all a dream, Bobby Ewing's back, the end.
Yeah,
you know, it's tough. So in terms of, you know, I am not 100% committed to always writing stories that are kind of sad or going into dark material. If I ever get away from that, I'll be probably the happiest person around. but I also remain open to the stories that come out of my pen.
So let me ask you this then, because a long time ago I learned I shouldn't write late at night, and by late at night I mean like 1-2 o'clock in the morning, because I go to places where I normally wouldn't go.
Okay.
How difficult is it for you to write that kind of stuff?
Some scenes in this book were very tough to write. Yes. It's a scale of 1 to 10, how difficult? Really high.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the scenes were. At the same time, then, there's this weird thing that happens, right, with writing. Like, I might write a scene that felt really dark, and I read it over, and just reading it, I'm seeing comedy. Comedy in the, you know, in the real.
Right,
it's
right.
Like, well.
Right.
So then I'm amusing myself. Like, you know, reading over what I thought, you know, in one of my last passes through the book, you know, before signing off on the galleys, I was reading over a scene that is particularly dark and saw something in it I'd never seen before, and I don't think I'd consciously put in it, and it made me laugh out loud.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, okay.
Well, that's good if you can make yourself laugh out loud.
It might have been the delusional writer. Look at me, wow. But, you know, so there is a certain act of faith in writing,
mm-hmm.
and that is commit to the story, and I'll serve the story. I won't try and steer it. I'll try and let it be an honest story unto itself. And I know it sounds weird saying honest when you're writing fiction, but what I mean by that is let the story feel whole and real and not feel like a cheat in any way.
Yes.
And it seems that in doing that, the reader will go with you. And the reader will take the pain in order to have also whatever joy there is there as well. And I think there is joy here.
Yes.
There's a certain sense of movement through the book. And it almost gives a sense of a life maybe just starting to loosen itself free into the world. A little late, 30 years old, but why not? Never too late, right?
It's never too late. And we need to take a quick break right here, but we will be right back. We're talking with author Ken Murray. His new book is called Eulogy. You are listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, and please stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Paper I know, places I go, make me feel tongue-tied. Like you see how people look down.
Do you love wildlife? Then make a real difference by helping PAWS care for sick and injured wild animals. Volunteers help feed and clean the animals until they are well enough to return to the wild. Sign up today and help save a wild life. No experience necessary. All training is provided. Visit paws.org or call 425-787-2500.
Coming up November 9th on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, we'll discuss the modern epidemic of burnout. Once you get there, it may seem there's no way out, but expert Steve McClatchy specializes in the art of reversing burnout. He's a guest lecturer at Harvard and Wharton and is the president of a Fortune 500 consulting firm and a featured expert with the Wall Street Journal Investors Business Daily, Fast Company, Men's Health, Success Magazine, and others. Join us every Monday at noon right here on Alternative Talk 1150 and listen to archive shows at conversationslive.net.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair with Conversations Live. If you'd like to gain more exposure for your business, service, or event, or if you'd like to raise awareness for an issue or topic you're passionate about, call me Let's talk about ways we might partner to shine the spotlight on you and bring you the recognition you deserve. Call me at 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617. Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair.
Ahead of the talk radio curve, naturally. Alternative Talk 1150.
And welcome back, everyone. We are talking with Canadian author Ken Murray. His new book is called Eulogy, and this is a novel. We've been talking about some of the dark places it goes. But I want to ask you, Ken, you introduce, and I understand this was very late into the writing of the book. I think it was like your final rewrite, and you introduce a brand new character. Why did you do that, and how did it change the story, and was it difficult to throw that character in so late in the game?
Well, starting backwards, yes, it was difficult, and there was a flurry of activity. I'll say, I had this book had been sitting on the shelf for some time, and I'd had an idea of what I'd do if I went back to it, but I'd never really gotten around to doing that. And then around the time a publisher came on board, and Tightrope Books, publisher, in acquiring it, you know, pulled me aside and said, no, I have this idea of something that might add to this. And then, are you open to suggestions? I said, of course I'm open. And what he brought forward was really almost the exact same thing I'd been thinking about, but I hadn't done yet. And we started working with an editor who, independently of us leading her in that direction, also came back with a similar thing. And it was really this. At that time in the book, William remains entirely a celibate man. He's never, he has no connections with any people, never had a lover of any kind. And what happened in the rewrite was instead to make this moment, to have a moment where he breaks away out of his shell a bit and does find, you know, with all his quirks, a lover, a girlfriend, you know, here at 29, 30 years old, who is compatible with him for the first time in his life. And what that introduced, the reason why that mattered in the end, is it introduced the possibility of things going well for him, a sense of movement that, and this happens very early in the book, but it creates that possibility, and then with that possibility then being taken out by his own basically self-destruction in the wake of, well, a lot of the forces happening within him. He self-destructs, his parents actually die, and the reader sees early on a chance where maybe he could have worked things out a bit with this person, and then it falls apart. And if anything, what it did was, instead of leaving vague that area of his sexuality or his potential to connect with other people, it showed the possibility of doing that and then have it destroyed, and that there's a certain poignancy that came with that, like a level of pathos that really just seemed to set the book started into the area it wanted to go that much more quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And I that's the short version of it.
Okay. And talking of short versions, you've done a lot of writing. You've done a lot of short stories. This is your first novel. What is the... Do you find one easier to write than the others? Because a lot of people think the short story is going to be easier, but for some people that's very difficult. So give us your perspective on that.
I don't think either are easy to write in any way.
Right.
They are for some people. I believe they might be for some people, but they aren't for me. The thing about a short story is we should not be confused by the idea that just because it's taking up, you know, less pages, you know, maybe it's only 2,000 words long, so whatever, 5 type pages or something like that, or, you know, plus minus a few thousand words, the writer has to cram into those very short space a connection the reader can have with the character on the page and the poignancy of whatever is going to happen to that character within that story. It's a very limited space of time, so you're talking extreme density. Because what happens in a short story, typically, is we meet a character, or two, or three, you never know, and Yeah, there's not a lot of typing involved, but boy, there's a lot of thought, a lot of feeling that goes into it. A novel, as you've just heard, hey, the writer can introduce a new character right at the beginning of the novel at the last minute and have her effect be felt through the entire book, because the book, because the novel provides that much space. And so the novel gives a writer a lot more flexibility to play with the story, to explore different avenues in it, we still have to worry about being, you know, economical and stylish on the page. You know, we have to write well, and but you know, we can have divergences in the story. Things can move around. We can have more than one moment.
Right.
So I think I you know what, in my descriptions, do either of them sound easy?
Neither one. Neither one sounds easy.
Okay, there you go.
And I know they're not, because you've got to have that cohesive story and it's got to pull people along regardless. So let's look at how you write in general. You're a creative writing teacher. Why do you think, you know, do you recommend people take classes? Because I've talked with a lot of writers, novices, who want to get published, but they do nothing to further their education in the writing field. So tell us the value in taking the kind of classes that you put on, for example.
Well, my classes are focused on getting writers started and getting them used to the idea of writing regularly and listening to their work and letting the stories emerge. And what I like to do is to try to provide structure so that each week that student, that writer, is going home to write. But unlike before they're taking the class, they're not just writing for themselves. They know they have an audience coming next week, and they're writing for someone else. And that structure, along with, you know, instruction and, you know, practice of skills, raises people's game. They understand that, you know, they start to move things along. Okay, this isn't just something I'm doodling at now. I've got a reader out there. I want to respect that reader. I want to take this story as far as I can go. How can I do that? And that seems to open up space to be able to learn just different skills and practice different skills.
Mm-hmm.
That was my experience in taking courses when I first started.
Well,
I was a published nonfiction writer for quite a few years, but really wanted to write fiction, and I hadn't a clue.
And it was so, really writing this book, wasn't it, that led to your career change?
You know what? Writing this book is what's been happening while my career's been changing,
mm-hmm.
I guess. But, you know, I go back again, those 10, 11 years ago, there I was sitting struggling with these stories I was writing, including that one of the father and the son at the amusement park I was telling you about. I didn't know how to do it. Like, I just sort of have these characters on the page, but, you know, what makes this work? What do I do next? I didn't know what I was working with. Like, what are the basic tools even that I should be working with here, or that I could be working with? And so I started taking classes kind of begrudgingly, because I said, oh, you know, writing can't be taught. I'm a teacher now. And I just found that structure, that every week someone's waiting for my work, along with the things I was taught, really did make a difference. That's what I try to create in the classes I teach now.
Right. How has, since you've put the, you told us how writing the book has changed your perspective. So how do you think talking about the book, because I think when you talk about it, you see a whole different level of change. How do you feel now looking back over this?
I remain as glad as ever that I wrote it. The one thing that does happen, and I welcome it, is, you know, when readers want to talk to me about the experience of reading the book, because I'm curious what they find along the way. And the one thing I do realize is that each person brings their own perspective and experience to any story. And some people react differently to different parts of it. And, you know, I didn't write the book with any specific, like, person or market or reader involved, apart from somebody who wanted a really good story. story. If somebody wants a good story, I'm going to write you the best, most honest story I can, and I hope you go with me, and that you'll get something out of that. And so, you know, from time to time, I get that note from someone, just, you know, here's relating either their own experience of life and how it relates to the book or something else, and I never tire of that. If I ever tire of that, I will not be doing this anymore.
We'll put you out to pasture, Ken, if you ever tire. We'll put you out to pasture if you ever tire of that.
Exactly, yes.
Well, Ken Murray, I really appreciate you being with us today. It's been great talking with you. The book is called Eulogy. I know listeners can find out more about you and your work at kenmurray.com. .ca, because we're in Canada. You're in Canada.
Yes, that's right. KenMurray.com is someone else.
Yeah, KenMurray.ca. Just remember that Ken's Canadian. And a final quick thought you'd like to leave our listeners with today.
Find books that take you on a good ride.
Love it.
And don't be scared of them.
Love it. Ken Murray, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
And we'll take a very quick break. When we come back, we'll be joined by returning guest, New York Times bestselling author Catherine Neville, and find out what she's up to lately. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Please do stay tuned.
Let's see if I guess that... This just isn't working.
Knowing you have a great idea for a book is one thing, writing it another. So what's stopping you? Maybe you can't find time. Maybe you don't know where to begin. Maybe you wrote a couple of chapters, then disappeared down a rabbit hole. Or maybe you'd rather someone else write it for you. Partnering with the right coach or ghostwriter can make all the difference between talking about your book and finishing your book. As an award-winning writer and strategic consultant, Vicki St. Clair's storytelling credits span from business, health, self-help, and memoir to New York Times and USA Today best-selling anthologies. Vicki partners with people just like you at the exact level you need, whether you need a little encouragement, editorial guidance, or full-blown ghostwriting and consulting services. If you're serious about telling the story you know is inside you, stop procrastinating. Let's get your story down on paper. Contact Vicki today. Email Vicki at VickiSt.Clair.com or call 1-800-495-7617. See more about Vicki and her work at VickiSt.Clair.com.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to the Ananda Institute of Living Yoga, we cover the world of animals. This week, November 1st, we'll be serving the human animal. With me in the studio, Susan Usha Derman, author of Calm and Compassionate Children, also a longtime member of Ananda and very involved with the Living Wisdom Schools. We'll explore the creation, history, philosophy, and curriculums of these schools in all locations worldwide. On Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
You listen when your body says, I'm tired, or I'm hungry. Are you listening? Would you listen if your body said, I have pain and pressure in my abdomen, I feel bloated for no good reason, or I get too full too fast? I'm spotting, but I've already gone through menopause. Or I have to go to the bathroom more often and more urgently than usual. These can be signs of a gynecologic cancer, like cervical, ovarian, uterine, vaginal, and vulvar cancers. Symptoms aren't the same for everyone. If your body says something may be wrong, please listen, learn the symptoms, and get the inside knowledge about gynecologic cancers. Call 1-800-CDC-INFO. A message from the Inside Knowledge Campaign and the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Coming up November 9th on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, we'll discuss the modern epidemic of burnout. Once you get there, it may seem there's no way out, but expert Steve McClatchy specializes in the art of reversing burnout. He's a guest lecturer at Harvard and Wharton and is the president of a Fortune 500 consulting firm and a featured expert with the Wall Street Journal Investors Business Daily, Fast Company, Men's Health, Success Magazine, and others. Join us every Monday at noon right here on Alternative Talk 1150 and listen to archive shows at conversationslive.net.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, talk radio to help you live well, live strong.
Write it down, shout it loud. Alternative Talk 1150 AM. Now, wasn't that fun?
And welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. We are talking now with returning guest Catherine Neville. She had a 20-year career as an international computer executive and consultant in the fields of finance and energy. That role took her to live and work in six countries on three continents and half of the states in America. And I know that has definitely helped shape the writing that she's done over the years. Her books include The Eight, A Calculated Risk, and The Magic Circle. They're bestsellers in more than 30 languages. The Fire was her long-awaited sequel to The Eight. And we're going to find out what she's up to right now. Catherine Neville, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. It's a delight.
Well, as a best-selling author, I know you were on the New York Times bestseller list with your books, and they've been around for a long time. What are you doing? Tell us, let's just jump in here, Catherine, and tell us what you're doing.
Well, right now I'm moving houses. I'm in the middle of, some people arrived a couple of months ago, and, I have the only Gothic, house according to the National Registry in all of Northern Virginia. Once you cross over the Maryland border, they're all Gothic because the Catholics settled Maryland and the Protestants settled Virginia.
Oh, interesting.
So these people wanted my house, and I said after a long time, you know, I don't really need a house. What I need is a tree house, because I wrote my first two books many, many years ago, as you said, while living in a 600-square-foot tree house in Sausalito, California.
I saw the photographs of it on your website, and I was very jealous.
I had photographs of it, and I have to tell you, I was out on book tour a few years ago, and I was talking about how I'd written my first two books in this tree house in Sausalito, and a woman came up after my book signing and said, you know, my husband and I bought the estate that the treehouse is on, and we're living there now. And after listening to you, I would really like for you to write your next book in the treehouse. It's available. And I said, well, do you want to rent it to me, or do you want to sell it to me? And she said, it's up to you. And she said, come and have lunch on Sunday. So in the middle of book tour, I went and had lunch with them. And an old friend of mine came, and the realtor, apparently the house, the estate had been listed in the newspapers in San Francisco saying, Catherine Neville wrote her famous book, The Eight, while living in the treehouse on this property.
Well, let's talk about The Eight.
They had copies of my books, and I went to have lunch, and the husband was from Algeria. He made us an Algerian lunch, and for those who have not read The Eight, at least half of the book is set during the French Revolution, and a big chunk of the book is set in North Africa in the Sahara Desert in Algeria, which is where some of these mysterious treasures are buried. And I rented that treehouse for 1 year. I went back and forth from Virginia, and they loaned it to me for another year. And So I telephoned to tell them I was selling my house in Virginia, and they said, well, we're selling our house, our estate in California. So everybody's moving, but it makes me feel, you know, it's I'm used to moving. You described my career very brilliantly. I heard you in the lead-in.
Right, and I wanted to talk about, there was an interesting story about how you actually got to Algiers, because I think you were about to quit your job, right? And you got called into your boss's office, and you said
I was going to quit my job because I was very frustrated at the fact that, you know, we weren't really giving the very best service to our clients. And so I saw him in the hallway. He was the head of the whole. He was the senior partner of the firm that will never be named. And I use this in the eight, by the way, this scene. But anyway, I was about to quit, and he said, I want to talk to you about something. And I said, well, I want to talk to you about something, too. And he said, come to my office at 3 o'clock today. So for some reason, when I walked into his office at 3 o'clock, I said, you go first, because I was going to say I was quitting. And he said, we have a new project starting up in Algeria. And I said, I'll go. And he said, do you know where Algeria is? And I said, no, but I'll look it up on a map.
and that influenced a lot of your writing then.
Yeah, it totally changed everything, because up until that point, I was one of the first people in the real first avant-garde of data processing, when all these huge companies that had pencils and pens and were keeping track of everything manually, all of a sudden they were all being automated. And so I knew all the different generations of computers. And so I basically got the job over there, even though I was a woman and it wasn't really acceptable for women to go running around the world doing business. But I knew all these technical things. So when I got over there, I realized that I had been outside of the country a lot, but the way most of us Americans are, we go outside the country and we stay in hotels that are filled with Americans, mm-hmm. and we eat at restaurants that are filled with Americans. And it was totally different, because the people I was associating with were either international consultants who were expats from somewhere else, or they were my clients who were from all over the world. It was only 10 years after the Algerian Revolution against the French, and which inspired The Day of the Jackal. Remember that famous book?
I do, yeah.
And
classic.
They tried to kill Charles de Gaulle because he gave Algeria back to the Algerians. So it was a really fascinating time, and I got to hear everything that had gone on in the Algerian Revolution, and it reminded me of the French Revolution, which we had all studied in, high school, grade school. It was like that. The French Revolution, the American Revolution was nothing, really. You know, it was important to us, but it didn't affect the rest of the world immediately. It was just a bunch of colonies revolting, and they still consider us revolting colonies. But the French Revolution brought down not just the nobility and the royalty and the bourgeoisie, but also the proletariat. You know, the rabble were ruling the revolution for a long period, and it shook up the entire structure of Europe. Whereas the Algerian Revolution was very similar up until then. I had grown up in the Cold War, and you know, East is East and West is West, and there was this, it was called a balance of power. It was a standoff. And all of a sudden, there's this new player in the game. And it really reminded me a lot of an incredible chess game that where you couldn't see the move coming from off the board. About a month before the OPEC embargo, which took place while I was living there, they had a third world conference. We called them the third world. They called themselves the unaligned nations. And they had tried to do what they called a boycott, a sort of embargo on all raw material. You realize these are countries in Latin America, countries in Africa. And if they had done an embargo on all the raw materials they produced, it would have included all the pharmaceuticals in the world practically.
Right.
You know, all the cork, all the, you know, whatever, to cork up wine bottles, rubber. So, but they were unable to reach a consensus on that. So it was really an incredible period of ferment.
But all of this influenced your writing and your books, and you just mentioned chess. And, you know, we should say for those who aren't familiar with the eight that it's There's a lot of chess talk in there.
Well, it isn't really. There's no real chess game that ever appears in the book.
Right.
But it is about a fabulous gold and silver bejeweled chess set that belonged to Charlemagne. And at the beginning of the book, it's been buried for 1,000 years. And it's dug up by these nuns in the Pyrenees and scattered all over the world. And from then, from the 1790s during the French Revolution to the 1970s during the OPEC petroleum embargo, for 200 years, everyone's chasing around the world trying to find these pieces and put them back together because they contain a secret of dark, mysterious power. And all the power players in history make guest appearances in this book, and they actually are pieces and pawns in the chess game, which is the plot of the book. I don't rub anyone's nose in it. I don't ever mention that the book is based on a chess game, but chess players figured it out right away that they're moving around in certain ways that create this kind of ambiance of being inside the board. So it was so much fun to write it.
I heard you say when you first wrote this book that they didn't know where to place it, because this was long before the Da Vinci Code and all of those subsequent books came out, and they didn't know which genre to categorize it in. So you were kind of leading the way there.
Yeah, in those days, you have to remember that bookstores had one section called literature and another section called fiction. And they had the horror novel. Stephen King used to say this as well. They were in the back of the 7-Eleven or they weren't even in the grocery store. And the romance novels were in the filling stations and supermarkets. So the genres were beginning to have a resurfacing of being serious books again, as they were, of course, during the time of Edgar Allan Poe. No one thought that horror novels were, they didn't like them then either, but at least he's considered great literature. And Stephen King had to break all those barriers. So here comes along little Catherine Neville with this book that I thought no one would ever want to look at.
Right.
In the publishing world, I thought they'd think, what is this? An intergalactic map of the universe?
And it's now how many years later? Because it was 88, wasn't it?
It was 88.
Yeah, so a long time.
Last year it had its 25th anniversary, and we had big celebrations around the world. Actually, the book bestseller list.
Catherine,
countries.
Yes,
so.
40 countries. It was on the bestseller list. But we are at the end of our segment, Catherine, and I do want to make sure that listeners know that you know, where you have a digital launch. These books are now in digital format for those who prefer the digital format, and they can find out more about that at your website, which is CatherineNeville.com. And I think the lesson I take away from you, Catherine, and I took it away from you last time, is something that Ray Bradbury said in one of his books, and that is, you know, to be a good writer, to be a good creative writer, you have to feast on life. And you've certainly done that with all the jobs. I mean, in addition to being a consultant and living in all those countries, you've been a banker, an international consultant, a computer expert, painter, waiter, photographer, model, and all of those, you say, feed your work. So I think that shows, and I really appreciate you being with us. So very quick final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with.
Oh, it's a great joy for me to be a writer, and I welcome everybody to the field. Anyone who's an aspiring writer, just write what you like, write what you love, and have fun.
There you go. And you look very good on it, and you still travel and still have fun. I can tell that. So thanks for being with us today, Catherine. Appreciate
it. It's been great, Vicky, as always.
And again, you can find out more about what's happening with Catherine's digital release at CatherineNeville.com. And, you know, for a book to be around that long, you know, a fiction book these days says something. So CatherineNeville.com is where you can find out more information. All right, that brings us to the end of our show. And I want to thank each of you for joining us today and spending this hour with us. You can find me at 800-495-7617 if you have questions or feedback on today's show, 800-495-7617. You'll also find us on Facebook at Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair and on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair. And I'm on special assignment next week, but we do have a show lined up for you, and I will see you live the following week. So until then, live well, live strong.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.